Radio City once again, John Grayson, Rob Ross coming at you live on tape, so recorded and not live at all. But Rob Ross, how's everything going? What a day we've had.
Yeah, it was a pretty good day, and things have been going fairly well for the last, well, since you and I spoke last. But yeah, today just turned from being reasonably decent and absolutely beautiful, you know, early autumn weather in New York, to just being abysmal. And, you know, it was bad enough to wake up and hear about this massacre in Las Vegas,
yep,
which we'll get to in a little while. But the news of Tom Petty has just rattled me to my core. I've got this, it's a cross between a void and this lump in my throat that just won't go away.
Yeah. And we've had several comparable in terms of musical influence. I mean, the loss of Prince, I think, is as unexpected, or was as unexpected, and is as much of a crack in the universe of music as losing Tom Petty. But I don't even know why particularly, but I'm in that same camp. And maybe it's because you and I both have been fans of his since we were kids. And that's not exaggerating matters.
No, I became a fan at the age of 11 when American Girl came out in the summer of 76. And, you know, that was the quintessential summer song, especially that year, because that was the year of the bicentennial. So, you know, once a fan, always a fan. And, you know, I really, even though, of course, I very shortly after embraced the punk rock lifestyle and ethos, you know, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were one of those bands that always stayed with you. You know, I was never really keen on the whole deny everything mentality of punk rock, the pretense of nothing's gone before this. That was just a lot of nonsense, because, you know, you and I grew up in a period when there was so much good music for kids like us, bands like Yes or ELP or King Crimson or Pink Floyd, for those of us who were into the prog rock scene, or, you know, Sabbath and AC/DC and the whole shun what went before just never jived with me. And so Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers was always a favorite of mine. And I always loved the fact that he embraced, it's funny how Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, for whatever reason, were lumped in sort of in the new wave, which I never really understood, but he seemed to be, he took it in his stride and he seemed to embrace the punks. That's for sure. I mean, listen, an audience is an audience is an audience, for a start. And that band put out incredible records. They had a run from the debut album, I would say, right through to Long Until Dark?
Yes.
And for me, even though I really did dig Damn the Torpedoes, which came out certainly when I was absolutely in the throes of the punk rock lifestyle, it was Hard Promises, which just completely spun me around. I mean, that was his artistic crowning glory, with or without the Heartbreakers. I mean, that's a song that's an album that has so much emotional impact on me. You know, I can remember seeing it for the first time and just buying it sight unseen. And this was even before I'd ever heard The Waiting on the radio. And hearing that opening Rickenbacker chord ring out. Song has lived with me to this day. I still do The Waiting as part of my acoustic set.
There was so much great music, and that's the thing about those first five or six Heartbreakers albums, is that you look at the songs on them and how many of them got radio play. Even if they didn't make it into the top 40, how many of them got major play on the air? And every one of those albums has at least five or six of them. And when you get into 1984 and the release of Southern Accents, Damn the Torpedoes was a breakthrough. And then 4 years later, or 5 years later, because, yeah, Damn the Torpedoes was 79. And 5 years later, when Southern Accents comes out, that is a band at its full maturity. And in the same way you are with The Waiting, I am with Rebels. Because Tom Petty, if for no other reason as a songwriter, has my deep respect because of his ability to write in character and his ability to write tongue-in-cheek lyrics. And that's what Rebels is.
For me is, you know, let's go back to Hard Promises for a moment. You know, when you're 16 and you're going through those first pangs of unrequited teenage love, which is just, you know, unadulterated torture.
Yeah.
The songs reach you in a way that they're articulate where you're not.
Right.
And they say, but they get to the heart of the matter. They speak in simple yet eloquent tongue. You know, whether it's The Waiting, A Woman in Love, Letting You Go. I mean, those are songs that are done with such pristine execution and yet such gusto. If you're in an emotional funk, it can definitely help bring you out of it. But certainly the lyrics of all those songs give you such pause for thought.
Right.
You know, it's just a stunning, stunning collection and like I said, between the, you know, we've had this conversation many times over the years, but there's one of those albums that it starts off with the Oh Let Me Up 1-2 punch of The Waiting and Woman in Love.
Yeah.
I mean, you just sit there and you're going, wow, you're left breathless. And Tom Petty, I mean, you know, we're sticking with an era, but, you know, let's face it, people really latched on after Southern Accents, but then Full Moon Fever came out and gave him a whole new audience. And of course, the time that he spent with the Traveling Wilburys, Tom Petty was a legend. Tom Petty was a rock god. Tom Petty deserved all the accolades, names, you name it. Tom Petty was one of the true, honest to God greats that came along in our lifetime. And we're just very, very fortunate to have had him, have his music, and have him make that kind of lasting impression on a couple of kids from New York.
Yeah, no kidding. And a couple of things about the punk connection, and I was able to look this up. We were talking about this before the show, and it was a Swedish LP that came out that was a split disc that was Rock On, the Ramones and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. So there was always that sort of connection between them and the punk world. And you know, what is even later in his iteration back in 1987, I think it was. I mean, what is Jammin' Me if not a punk song? You know, it's got a little bit of a Southern vibe to it, but that's a punk song. And it's basically giving the finger to everything that's popular and plastic at the moment.
Well, you know, here's a key thing. He did something that was indeed very punk and certainly earned him the endless deep respect of musicians and fans alike when he was willing to go on strike against MCA Records.
Yep.
For wanting to charge more than the standard retail price for what was going to be released as Hard Promises. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, he wore that T-shirt that said on strike against MCA,
mm-hmm.
you know, in concert. And that's why they became known as such an incredibly great live band, because the only way they were able to survive while they were being choked off by the record label was to go out and play as many dates as possible in 80, 81, until MCA, of course, relented. Wisely.
Yeah.
But the thing is that Tom Petty didn't play by anybody's rules, you know, and I think that's what made him so special. He dug all of it, you know, and let's not forget, you know, by 87, he was covering, I think it was on Pack Up the Plantation, the hit single from that, which is a live record, was their version of So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, which had been resurrected by our dear friends REM not too long before. So who knows? You know, look, it's the whole Rickenbacker connection.
Yeah, that's right. So, that conglomerate. And I was lucky enough on that Southern Accents tour that we mentioned the album a little bit earlier to see that concert at the Sundome at USF in Tampa. And Roger McGuinn, who lived in Clearwater at the time, joined Tom Petty on stage for So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, and I think two or three others as well. It was just an amazing show and a great sort of handshake between the generations over that song.
You know, I saw him last, what was it, a little over a year ago, you know, and opening up for him was Steve Winwood, who joined him at the end of the show, which was just magnificent. I mean, I think we actually spoke about it on Overnight America because I was grousing how after every song he would change guitars. It was like he had the guitar shop with him.
Yeah, yeah.
From SG to the Rickenbacker to the Tele to the Vox to the this one to the that one. It's like, dude, stop. Just keep playing.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you from a secondhand story that Tom Petty is extremely, or was, extremely picky about his guitars. I mean, extremely picky. But hey, you know, he earned his stripes, no doubt about it. So sad loss. And it, you know, it doesn't even, it's odd. And you mentioned this at the outset. It's hard to put this into perspective because here we are talking about the loss of one man on the very same day that we learned about the death of what is now, at this recording, 58 people and the wounding of 500 others at a concert in Las Vegas, Nevada. And that happened late on Sunday night, and we're talking on Monday afternoon. And it's, you know, it's hard to call the loss of one man a tragedy in the wake of the loss of 58. And yet, you know, the two have really no connection other than they've happened to coincide in time and made us feel even worse about why we even got out of bed today.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, the morning started off just fine because today is the fifth birthday of my younger cat, my beloved Roxy.
Happy birthday, Roxy.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, she still looks like a kitten. She's a permakitten.
Yep.
I mean, she's still tiny. And today also happens to be my 19th wedding anniversary.
Oh, happy anniversary.
So, thank you, brother. So, you know, that was a good way to start the day off. And then you turn on the news and subsequently was immediately shot to hell. Now, the thing about Tom Petty is that, A, we're talking about it merely hours after this has happened. You and I usually talk in a wrap-up fashion after the fact.
Right.
You know, case in point, I don't think I could have spoken to you coherently the day that Grant Hart died. But, you know, we're talking about Tom Petty a few hours after the news. And again, with the massacre in Las Vegas, all I'm going to say is this, and you can take it for what it's worth. I think all bets were off when basically the powers that be found a way to skirt around the facts and basically were able to justify children being massacred in a school. So once Sandy Hook happened and nothing changed,
right,
a collective washing of the hands. And I'll say no more than that. You know, you can take that for whatever it's worth.
Well, and there's a couple of things. I think everybody at this point is looking for some kind of meaning in this through motive. In other words, what they're doing is they're trying to figure out, well, who was this guy? Why would he do something like this? And what we're finding out now is that this is a guy who had a pretty good life. He had made a lot of money in one industry or another. He was a multimillionaire, and he was living a quiet, normal life that wasn't really bothering much of anybody, had one lawsuit a few years ago against a casino. So that question of why would he do something like this is the same frustrating question that we've been asking, and it's a double-edged sword because we're never going to find a motive that's going to make sense to us. There's never going to be a time when we're going to go, oh, well, then that makes sense to kill 58 people you don't know. That's not going to happen. So in the search for putting this into some kind of box, we're just kind of left in that lurch of, well, it's never going to make sense, and yet we need something to make ourselves feel better about all of this. And I don't know where to go with it after that, other than to say that kind of, you know, even when the answers come, even if they find something on his computer that says, I was pissed off at my milkman and that's why I did this, it's still going to seem like an awful, shitty, senseless thing to do, because it is.
The thing that has me perplexed, because the facts have been coming in sketchy drips and drabs is the girlfriend's involvement in this, because several reports had her telling people, and I don't know what people or where or when, a lot of you are going to die tonight.
Ugh.
I mean, this is, you know, start with that. You know, so where, how much depth is her involvement in this?
Right.
You know, 64 years old, that's, you know, kind of an oddity, because it's usually, and I'm not, you know, trying to fit this in a nice little package, but usually it's somebody younger.
Right.
You know, 64 years old, retired, enjoyed gambling, had no run-ins with the law per se. Yet this morning they were touting him as somebody who had been on their radar.
Yeah, for what?
Again, we don't know these things. And that's what's making this even worse, because the reporting has been no less than poor, in my opinion.
Right.
We're not getting – it helps for a person to at least gain some perspective when you have the facts put out there for you. What are the facts? But this whole thing is so murky and so scattershot at this point that I can't make heads or tails out of it.
So here's the social commentary that goes along with this, is the fact that because, and we've talked endlessly about this, about the divisive nature of everything, and the fact that nobody can see logic because all we see is our side and fuck the other guy. Into the middle of this nature, once you're expecting it to happen, and I posted something on Facebook this morning about, oh, let me guess, it's too early to talk about gun control, right? And sure enough, right out of Sarah Huckabee Sanders' mouth this afternoon comes those exact words, oh, it's too early to talk about policy changes. When the fact is, no, it isn't. It's been too late for a long damn time. But that notwithstanding, out steps this now former CBS executive and posts something on Twitter about how she doesn't have any sympathy for the people that were slaughtered in Las Vegas because most country music fans are gun-toting Republicans. You know what, lady? Fuck you. They didn't ask you for any sympathy, and I'm glad you got your ass fired.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a wow. You know, this is – I've said it to you before, and I'll say it again, and I say this on a fairly regular basis, and mark my words, it's coming to a greater head. This is exactly the kind of thing that the new left does and says without thought,
yep.
without any kind of moral backbone or common decency. This is the kind of thing that they say and do that makes people turn to the right.
Yeah. Right. And that's that kind of piss off. It stops people from thinking logically, because all we can see is how angry we are at her. And she's not even part of the issue. And yet she inserted herself into it by saying something stupid. And that seems to be in American society today. All you have to do.
This is it, Matt. This is what social media has done to people. People think that they've got a vested interest in saying something so profound, and even if it's the most callous and thoughtless and heartless thing you can possibly say, they're going to say it because it gives them a spotlight, because everybody has that sick need,
right,
to be in the limelight, even for a moment, even in the worst way possible. You know, look, you have to think logically, and I'm talking absolutely logically about trying to get all the necessities, the supplies, the clothing, food, water, whatever it is, to Puerto Rico after the hurricane.
Right.
You know, it wasn't easy to get stuff to Houston immediately afterwards, and it wasn't easy to get to the necessary places in Florida. So people who, the minute the hurricane ceased and moved away from the Puerto Rican shore, suddenly jumped upon the opportunity to start saying, why isn't, you know, Trump doing something? Hold on for a moment. You have to assemble the necessary goods. You have to assemble the necessary people to get the goods there. Is the American government and is Donald Trump responsible for the roads not being clear in Puerto Rico so the trucks can't leave when there were relief supplies there already that had gotten there as fast as they could? It is not anyone's fault. It is by virtue of nature. And people have to take responsibility for themselves as well, instead of being handheld and babied throughout it. And I really think that the mayor of San Juan made a grandiose mistake by waving the red flag at the bull known as Donald Trump.
Right.
It's by tweeting that comment that she made about him. Whereas I think the governor of Puerto Rico did a very smart and astute thing and became the buffer. You know, Trump took the bait, of course, as he's wont to do. He's
right.
always going to.
Yep.
But it didn't stop him from continuing to send relief down there. And people are going to say, well, you know, what took them so long? Again, you've just had a major hurricane in a place that is not as easy to access from surrounding states, like Florida might be, from you know, Georgia or Alabama or what, you know, and Texas, you know, coming from, you know, Missouri or Tennessee or Oklahoma or wherever you're going to come in from. This is an island in the middle of the water. It's far more remote. You have a lot of supplies that you have to bring there. It doesn't happen because you demand it to be so.
Right.
That's the problem with, you know, these social justice warriors want things to be done in the blink of an eye. You know something? I hate to break it to you people, but Obama's government kind of dragged their feet in many, many, many ways all too often. You know, he did the best that he could. Trump is doing the best that he can. Three consecutive hurricanes. Do you not fathom that?
Right. Well, and of course, he doesn't do himself any favors by going big water, ocean water, lots of water. Shut up, you moron. You know?
Right.
But
shut
you
up
know.
And just do things.
But it's meaningless.
People would be far more, you know, they'd be far more receptive
yep.
if you just shut up and did the work. But you can't because you're an asshole.
Right. Oh, what a world in which we live. And as Radio City continues, I mean, we could spend hours on all of these things, and unfortunately, it wouldn't leave us time for anything else. But there is more to talk about, and we spent a little time with television last time around and talking about cutting the cord and getting rid of cable or satellite or whatever, but there are still reasons not to. And one of the reasons is it's not impossible, but it's really difficult to find Comedy Central anywhere other than your local cable system or your local satellite provider. So you miss out on an awful lot. And there's a couple of TV shows that have come back. And there's one new one I want to get to talking about as well. But what's back on Comedy Central right now?
Well, my favorite, Tosh.0's new season is on. And South Park returned. And I got to tell you, it took three episodes to finally hit stride because the first two were just not funny.
Really?
Quite honestly. Yeah, the first two just, I don't know, they just left me feeling blank. One was based around Tweek and Craig and Tweek's obsession with being nuked by North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't funny. And well, the first one had its moments. The first episode was you know, a spoof of all these buying and selling of houses kinds of shows that you see on DIY Network.
Oh, yeah, the flip this house thing, yeah.
Yeah, so this was white people renovating houses.
You know. Well, that is all there are, yeah.
Starring, of course, Randy and Sharon Marsh, you know, because Randy's an idiot. But this last episode was hilarious because it was all about people wanting their DNA tests so they can be, you know, maybe think that they've got some Native American blood because they're all being indigenous. And of course, he misappropriates the word indigenous, and it works beautifully. Watch it. It's hysterical. Tosh, on the other hand, he takes no prisoners. He makes no apologies. He's got the balls. I mean, listen, he was making jokes about Charlottesville as quickly as possible. Go for it. That's what I say.
Yeah. Well, and also on Comedy Central, there was one new show that debuted, and it's a spinoff of the sort of last vestiges of the Jon Stewart Daily Show, because Jordan Klepper was there and he was brought in for about the last half a season when Jon Stewart was on. And he's been on with Trevor Noah since the beginning and now has his own show. And in the same way that Stephen Colbert built his character around a parody, effectively, of Bill O'Reilly and Sean, whatever the hell his name is that I can't stand.
Sean Hannity.
Sean Hannity, yeah. See, that's how much I hate that guy. I can't remember his name.
His Rutherford B. Hayes haircut.
Yeah, what a douchebag. So in that same vein, what they're doing with Jordan Klepper is trying to turn him into that kind of funhouse mirror version of the InfoWars guy. And it, I can see where they're going with it. I've laughed at it a couple of times. It needs a lot of work. I'm hoping that it hits stride, because right now it's just not giving me a whole lot of reason to watch it every day.
The first few reviews that I've read were just scathing.
Yeah.
Really were. You know, remember the review of Spinal Tap's Shark Sandwich album?
Yeah. right around the same vein.
Shit sandwich.
Yeah, it just... I see where they're going, and I wish that he fit that character better, and he doesn't.
The problem is, with all of these, quote, comedy shows, they, A, are trying too hard.
Yep.
Right out of the chute, the writers are trying too hard. B, it's pushing an agenda, which isn't going to work because it's going to become a turnoff. The whole point of watching comedy is to laugh, not to be beaten over the head with a message. Donald Trump's a dick. The Republicans are all assholes and aren't, you know, Obama's still our president, which he's not.
Right.
You know, this is the kind of shit that's getting this country in deeper and deeper trouble every single day. The delusion factor.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to take responsibility for anything. They want to place the blame, but there's no responsibility to be accepted by the Democrats. You know, I mean, not to get away from the topic of Comedy Central, but do we have to keep rolling Hillary Clinton out? You know, do you not remember now we're nearly a year from the election, okay? We're a month away from it. Think about that. And people are still beating the same drum over and over and over again. It's over.
Right.
Okay. It is over. Donald Trump is the president of the United States, okay? If you're so hopped up on getting him and getting anyone who might even think like him out of office, you have to find strong candidates and work on the here and now and the future.
Bless you.
Sitting there going on about last year and blaming the Russians and blaming this one and blaming that one. I've said it before. I'll say it again. I voted for Hillary Clinton. I supported her completely. Certainly, I supported her and would never even think to support you-know-who, whose name I won't mention, but he's a Jew from Brooklyn who moved to Vermont and has done nothing in the 40-plus years he's been in the Senate. I think we all know who I'm talking about, that fucking communist.
Yeah.
But you need to find people in the here and now. You also need to go in a younger direction.
Well, right. And that's the thing that's killing me right now is even when they show a Democrat on TV, who is it? It's Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi. Which one of them is going to challenge Donald Trump for the presidency three years from now?
I would sooner vote for Donald Trump than Nancy Pelosi.
There you go. And that's the problem. There's nobody. I mean, where the hell is Cory Booker?
I don't know. I mean, here's a guy who has always – he doesn't talk the talk. He just walks the walk.
Right.
I mean, this is a guy who's really someone we should all be looking at.
Yep.
The thing is, maybe he just doesn't want that kind of responsibility. Maybe he feels – I mean, for God's sakes, he was basically Superman when he was the mayor of Newark.
He pulled people out of a burning building. I mean, come on.
I mean, the thing is, in all seriousness, you know – he did something with that city that no one did, not in my lifetime. And he made it a livable, workable city where jobs were coming back. Businesses were opening. You know, they had the Prudential Center. All these things were starting to happen. And the minute he left to become senator, that city turned right back into a shithole.
Yeah. Yeah. Which means that, again, it was his doing. It was his administration and his leadership. So that ought to tell everybody something. But for crying out loud, somebody needs to start touting him. And I think that's the one thing. You put it very, very correctly when you said that he doesn't do it for the photo op. The problem is if at that level, if he's not going to stand up and toot his own horn a little bit, nobody else is going to do it for him. And I think that's why he's sort of disappeared halfway through the election cycle last time around.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When he came out and gave his keynote speech, I felt like that was sort of his coming out party. Like, okay, he's the next in line. But the thing was, as I watched him, and I don't know if you caught this, but he just seemed very uncomfortable on that kind of a stage.
Yep.
It's one thing to be in front of the cameras in your city if you're the mayor. It's one thing to be in front of the cameras if you're a senator, because senators don't often speak.
Right.
It's another thing to be speaking as the keynote speaker at the Democratic National Convention and possibly being thought of as the next one.
Right. And he's not an asshole. So maybe the prospect of having his life ripped apart in front of the entire country is just not something that appeals. And honestly, I couldn't blame him.
No, I mean, look, that is a job that you have to have a certain kind of dickishness about you. And I don't care who you are to become president. You have to have an ego that is so insatiable and you have to be so power hungry. I could give less than a fuck about anything. You know? I mean, really, what do I care about? I care about music, my cats, the New York Rangers, the New York Mets, good Mexican food, you know, and that's really it. I mean, you know, and Big Star. Yeah.
Right. Well, good. So let's talk about music a little bit because we do have some to spotlight. And you turned me on to somebody that I really love. And I hope we're going to be able to talk in the next iteration of this show about one that I hipped you to a couple of days ago. But there's a band called Laura Hope and the Arctones, and they've got new music out. And again, from right down the street from you.
Laura Hope and the Arctones are a ska, swing, almost country billy band.
Yep.
Kingston, New York, which you wouldn't expect. Kingston's a great town. I will tell you that right away. It's a beautiful town.
Sure.
You know, they have the wonderful O Festival every year, which is just fantastic. People should check that out if they're nearby. But this is a band that's actually driven by a husband and wife duo. He's the stand-up bass player. And their sound, first of all, the way that they're produced absolutely harkens back to those late 50s, early 60s records that you and I love the sound of, that kind of buoyant live room with a lot of natural slapback and reverb.
Right.
A really crisp sound, a lot of call and response. The music is good time music.
I don't want to know about those other guys you've been with.
I'm the one for you.
I don't want to know about those other guys you've been with.
I'm the one for you.
Did he hold the door? Did you beg for more? Was he in a band? Did he hold your hand? Did he like to smoke? Could he tell a joke? I'm the one for you.
Oh, I'm the one.
I'm the one.
I'm the one.
I'm the one.
I'm the one. Oh, I'm the one. Hey, believe me, baby, I'm the one for you. Yeah.
That's how I would like to look at it.
Yeah, and it does. It has not only the sound, but it has the feel to it as well. I mean, it's got a little bit of the sort of, without the surfiness about it, it's got a very Dick Dale sort of production style to it. And I love that stuff. I can listen to it all day. It's like if you took Jerry Lee Lewis and put him in a production that sounded like Dick Dale, and her voice on top of all of that is just wonderful.
Right. She's got that wonderful kind of brassy but never abrasive kind of voice. You know, like
right.
she doesn't fake a growl that you know a singer is overreaching with.
Right. Right. But her voice is a little deeper, I think, just a tad, than the average female singer. So the fact that she hits the notes as cleanly as she does sets her apart. It makes her sound a little bit different, and it's a very appealing kind of sound.
And the band themselves, I mean, they're just – you could tell how – you could tell that these probably didn't take too many takes.
Right.
You know, that they have this clean, crisp tightness to them. And I'm talking about tightness in the sense that they've been at it for so long and they're so good at it live. They just walk in, set up, and start playing.
Right.
You know? But the other thing is about this album is that it has some surprises. Like, there's one particular song that I really hone in on. It's called This Is What I've Got. And it's a very slow, very pure, old-fashioned country ballad, you know, with a very sweet-sounding and mournful fiddle and these beautiful, shimmering and chiming pedal steel runs, which you wouldn't expect, you know. Maybe if the predominant amount of songs on the album weren't as buoyant as they are, you know, you would think, wow, this really sticks out like a sore thumb. But when you're reading your way through the album and you see how broad they are, it works perfectly.
That's great.
It's like a perfect balance in that album.
And the name of the album again is?
The album is called Love You to Life.
Very cool. So make sure that you catch that one and that you catch the review online at popdose.com. The other band that we're going to check out is actually a guy by the name of Sven Erik Olsen. And with a name like that, could he have come from anywhere other than the Twin Cities?
I was wondering the same thing myself. We were wondering if you have a room to rent.
And again, this one sounds not really anything like his name would dictate that you would think he would sound. He doesn't sound like a Youper.
Well, here's the thing. First, let me just say this one. Thy is Ollie. I am Sven. Now,
well done.
The way this was presented by way of the publicist is a replacements kind of vibe, which I always get a little bristled by.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really hate when somebody's automatically pigeonholed musically and because they're from a place. This gentleman has a fantastic sound, first of all. Does in fact sound more like Paul Westerberg's solo, which is never a bad thing because Westerberg's solo is a far cry from the Replacements. The Replacements had their peak with Pleased to Meet Me, without a doubt, because that was the first time they ever played in a straightforward manner rather than the drunken melee that we were very much accustomed to at that point. Now, to hone in on Sven Erik Olsen, this is his first record, and it's such an interesting story that I actually have to share it. He spent his childhood imagining bands, you know, drawing imaginary album covers, having track listings, bios of these fake band members, even writing in the duration and then playing times of each song. And even though he grew up and raised a family, he filed away those old notebooks and started going back to them. And so he started to refer to them and started writing songs that would fit what he had as his ideal back then. Hence, the album is called Sketchbook Traces.
Yeah.
And the thing is that the songs are very much fully realized. He has a way and a knowledge and a skill of writing that perfect kind of acoustic-based pop, you know? I mean, the first song is great. It's called Pop Bottle Green Eyes. You think it might come from the late 60s or maybe even lost from the Paisley Underground revival of the early 80s.
Yeah.
Right? You know, he has little nuances like very Beach Boys kind of break in the middle of the song filled with harmonies. He's definitely taken pages from the Big Star book. There's a track called Lilt, which is basically the only way to really look at it is it's a mixture of Everybody Hurts, some smatterings of the Velvet Underground and the Rain Parade. There's some kind of weirdnesses in there that made me think right away of the quieter bits from Big Star Third, but sung by Tom Verlaine.
Okay.
You know, if you could picture that. All in all, I really hope that this is just the beginning and that he's going to put something else out because he's someone to keep on the radar.
Definitely. Yeah. Especially if he's got a lot more of those notebooks lying around. So definitely. Well, again, another one that you've got to check out is Sketchbook Traces by Sven Erik Olsen. And you mentioned that there's a reference to the Replacements with a lot of the people who pay attention to this kid and what he's up to. Which brings us quite nicely into our next version of or look back at 1984.
Yeah. The next one was the other big album, the holy trinity of that particular summer of the American Underground, and that is the Replacements' Let It Be, which was, I think, their big shift towards a more mainstream or coherent sound. You know, if you don't know that much about the Replacements, they were raw and raucous, loud, you know, snotty for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
You know, they were drunken and drugged out assholes. And, you know, but there was a sense of humor, but you could tell that Paul Westerberg had a talent, had a gift for crafting a melody and putting together a powerful song, because their prior album, Hootenanny, had so many great tracks, but I don't want to go off on Hootenanny. I want to talk about Let It Be, because the first single was the indication that, hold on, there's a direction shift with the Replacements, because I Will Dare, which was produced by Pete Buck, actually, in which he plays guitar as well, this was something that no one would have expected out of the Replacements, I don't think. You know, it's as poppy and catchy and memorable from the first moment you hear the guitar chimes come in. And you knew that this band could be poised for some kind of greatness.
Yeah.
Now, this is an album that had one of the most overwhelmingly painful, and I do mean painful, that was a demo too, painful love songs in Answering Machine, you know, with a line for all time, like, how do you say I love you to an answering machine? But also on that album, Androgynous, which is them kind of being witty and clever, kind of a, almost like a an Algonquin Round Table kind of bit of humorous prose. Here comes Dick, he's wearing a skirt. Here comes Jane, she's sporting a chain.
Right.
And also Unsatisfied, which is, I think, Westerberg at his best. Yeah, it's got songs like Tommy Gets His Tonsils Out and stuff like that, but. And their version of Black Diamond.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But really, this was the album that was the big shift. You knew that after this record, it was either major label and stardom or bust. And as we all know, you know, they did go. They were the first to make the move and go to Sire Records and put out the album Tim in 1985, which I think is an absolute landmark record. But stardom eluded them. True stardom. That album was filled with so many singles, it's almost criminal.
Right.
To get back to Let It Be, you know, it was during that notorious moment when we were reading The Aquarian. And in the day that we went to the city, when this happened, we actually wound up going to the city because we had nothing to do. And I picked up Double Nickels and Zen Arcade. Mark had picked up Zen Arcade and Let It Be. So, again, it was more his obsession and love of the Replacements that, you know, brought them more to my attention, because I listened with almost as much fervor as he did. But I was still getting more absorbed by the Minutemen. And, you know, that's my disclaimer right there. Everything paled in comparison to the Minutemen.
Yeah.
Once I had Nickels on the Dime. You know, Husker Du was slightly, just slightly not on par with the Minutemen for me. But, you know, I thought the Replacements had that something. They had that something special. And what it really was, as we found out later on, was Paul Westerberg's obsession and love for Big Star and Alex Chilton, which, of course, we all know they did a song called Alex Chilton as a tribute. That was because the story goes Alex Chilton was opening up for the Replacements somewhere. I think it might have been in New York. And very famous photographer Stephanie Chernowski, who was friends with Alex Chilton, said to him, go back and introduce yourself. Paul loves you. He would be thrilled. And as a result of that meeting, Alex Chilton produced the demos that got them signed to Sire Records.
That's
so
cool.
The song was their way of saying thank you. And there's this great little clip of an interview with Westerberg where he goes, you know, he doesn't want our help. He doesn't feel he needs our help, but damn it, he's going to get it anyway. You know?
Yeah. Well, and that album, see, for me, 1984, in among other things, was also my first year of high school. And I remember hearing about that album and then hearing much more about the Replacements from the cool kids with long hair. And that, to me, that was like, oh, wow, yeah, the guys who are seniors and the cool kids with the long hair, they're all listening to these guys, so I need to pick up this record. And was not disappointed. You know, it was always the ones who were... You didn't know that they were smoking dope after class or between classes, but you had a pretty good indication they probably were, you know, but they weren't the dangerous kids. They were just the ones who knew their shit.
Right. And the thing is, you know, that was actually before we were in our dope smoking moron phase. I think that's actually a replacement song.
Yeah.
Off of either Stink or Sorry Ma Forgot to Take Out the Trash, but you know, the thing is, the Replacements, they took their spot in that pantheon that summer, and rightly so, because again, that album was a different angle of the whole punk feel. You know, you had Husker Du, also from Minneapolis, but Husker Du, theirs was a sonic assault with very heavy, personal, and intense lyrics. The Minutemen were jagged and, you know, free form. They weren't just punk rock. The Replacements were, with that album, I think, bridging the gap of the punkier element of what they had previously done. And you could see the way forward to a poppier, albeit still energetic, direction.
Right. They were becoming craftsmen.
Right, right. And Westerberg really was just rapidly, and I can't even say that enough, rapidly maturing as a songwriter, because for all the goofy songs like Gary's Got a Boner or Take Me Down to the Hospital or any of those other songs, you know, you have Answering Machine and you have Unsatisfied. I mean, my God, that is easily one of the best songs of the 80s.
Right.
Gary's definitely one of the best singles of the 80s. The other thing is also, when you look at the Replacements, they were originally thought of as kind of a hardcore band. Why? Because they played so damn fast. This is them completely slowing it all down, you know? And they also became long-haired. They didn't look like a punk band by any stretch.
Yep.
They looked like a bunch of jackass mechanics, the guys who will, you know, check your tires and your oil.
Which is probably, yeah, how they would have rather been known. So, yeah, it's just another landmark from 1984, and I can't wait to see what you've got in the bag for us for the next one.
Oh, yeah. You know what? We'll just wait until next week's show, and then we'll just start talking about it. I mean, of course, I'll tell you in advance so you get a flavor for it. But, it's just continuing on with the theory of the records that came out in the United States. You know, again, these are all indigenous American records. Did you notice I used the word indigenous?
Very good.
The American underground of 1984, as it was supposed to be. It wasn't a pre-planned thing. It was, in fact, just this wonderful, spontaneous, organic thing that happened at the right moment.
Right, yeah.
But before, you know, it was spearheaded, I think, in large part by Reckoning, because Reckoning came out in April. But still, these records are the core of what really made the American underground explode above ground. And I want to just say one thing. It was not long after that. It was actually in spring of 86, or actually early summer of 86, I apologize, that I went to see the Replacements. And I can honestly say that was the moment when I went to see them that I turned on them and would never forgive them, because first of all, I had a hangover that could kill a horse.
Yeah.
And it was my girlfriend, God rest her soul's, high school graduation that day. And my gift to her was taking her to see the Mats, as they are lovingly known, at the Ritz. Green on Red was the opening band. They were terrific. No question about it. The Replacements come out on stage and proceed to, I'm not kidding, never make it through one fucking song.
Ugh.
Not one. They were so doped up and so drunk, and they were just standing there on stage giggling and laughing at the audience and taking their clothes off and swapping instruments and let's fuck around in front of everybody who's been waiting here and drinking because it was a show sponsored by St. Pauli Girl. Just as we decided to say fuck it and leave, people started hurling beer cans at the stage.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's time to go.
Well, you know what? A fully loaded can connected, and that was when Westerberg's wrist got broken. And I have to admit, I thought, good, you deserve it, you fuckers.
That's funny.
Turn me off to the replacements. I wanted to forgive, but I never could. Yeah. You know, yeah, I really did like the Pleased to Meet Me album, but by then you knew it was already over. Like, they were never going to be what they were supposed to have been.
They didn't
take the mantle.
And like most of those stories, it's because they stood in their own way. And it's funny, because you were talking about 1984, is that year of sort of confluence. And if you look back over the history of it, 1958 was a confluence like that. 1967 was a confluence like that. 1984 was a confluence. And it's been a while, at least in the sort of pop rock realm, since there has been one of those. And I don't know if there ever will be again. But, you know,
it just makes me want to throw up. I would say 91, because that was when
grunge
and grunge, but grunge is shit.
Yeah, so. Right. But it still was what it was. So you're right. It was another one of those confluence years. But yeah, and maybe 96.
The Britpop thing?
Yeah, the Britpop thing and the Phoenix sound, the Gin Blossoms, the Refreshments, Dead Hot Workshop, blah, blah, blah. That was all 1995,
96. Here's the thing about, you bring up a really good point. It's always these city scenes that always get touted as something because we had a few that actually worked.
Right.
The first one was the Hoboken scene. And at the same time, the original Athens, Georgia scene.
Yep.
You know, but then people go to mine these towns, or they move there to think that they, you know, if they drink the water, they'll suddenly become, you know, A, part of the community, and B, a star. You know, you've had these very ill-advised scene toutings. Now, the Minneapolis scene was a completely indigenous thing to itself. There's that word again. it worked because it wasn't just who screwed you with the Replacements. It was the Suburbs. It was the Crackers. Before all of that, it was the Suicide Commandos. You know, it was Curtis A. and so many, so many great bands from Minneapolis.
Right.
Inclusive of that is Prince, because when he began, this whole thing was already starting to happen, based around the First Avenue entry, right? But so few city scenes were, in fact, real scenes. I mean, the Chicago scene was very under the wire. You know, you had Naked Ray Gun, you had Strike Under, you had the Effigies, you had Rifle Sport. Okay. Boston, you had the whole Tang Records scene. By the way, notice there were always labels that went along with these cities.
Right.
You know, Twin Tone, Minneapolis, Touch and Go, Chicago, Boston, Tang Records. That was more of a hardcore scene, a very specific thing. It wasn't accessible, you know.
Right.
And with Athens, it was all aligned with Atlantis DB Records, you know, which was started by Danny Beard, who put out the first 52 single and then put out the first Pylon single. And from there, it just went.
Yeah.
But other cities that over these years, you know, oh, Omaha. There's no fucking Omaha scene.
Well, right. But, you know, in the last year that I lived in my hometown, where I had moved back to, the last year that I lived in Buffalo was 1988. And at that point, because there was one band that grew out of not even just the city, but out of one particular avenue, Elmwood Avenue in North Buffalo goes right by Buffalo State College. And University of Buffalo is kind of a different thing, but Buff State is very much that. It's the working class kids who are also intellectuals, and because of that, there was some great music there. And the Goo Goo Dolls were nowhere near the best band on Elmwood Avenue. They just happened to be the ones that got famous. So there was a scene, kinda, but the only band that anybody's ever heard of from that scene was the Goo Goo Dolls. So
just brought it back full circle. The Goo Goo Dolls were the most watered-down version of the Replacements.
Yes, right.
Pure and simple. I have no grievances with the Goo Goo Dolls. I don't know them. I've never heard anything bad about them. But the thing is, they were just watered down. I mean, the minute I heard them, apart from the fact that I thought that was one of the stupidest names I've ever heard. So Dave Grohl should take comfort in knowing that Foo Fighters is not the stupidest name of a band.
Right.
Goo Goo Dolls is far and away much stupider. I just thought, man, this guy just sounds way too much like Westerberg, except he doesn't have the raw gut emotion that Westerberg actually was putting out there.
Right, the edge wasn't there.
Yeah, this is formulaic.
Yeah, well, and it just, you know, it's part of that thing that, again, you can't force it. You can't make a scene happening. You can't make it palatable anywhere other than where it grew up. It either happens or it doesn't. So,
right. I mean, you know, there's a lot of arguments that are made about the whole West Coast, especially like the Huntington Beach and, you know, Southern California hardcore punk scene where Black Flag grew out of, or the Adolescents, or, you know, all of those bands. But, you know, it wasn't like they were all of one mind either.
Right.
You know?
Well, before we get to In Our Heads, we've got a little bit of sports to talk about. And you know that as a Buffalo kid, I got to be happy about the fact that my Bills are now 3-1 and in first place, because the New England Patriots finally suck the way we all knew they did.
Well, my beloved New York Jets are 2-2 with the same record as the fucking New England Patriots.
Yep.
Because after dropping the first two games of the season, the Jets have won the last two. Yesterday, in convincing fashion, because they had a solid lead and then fucked it all up in the fourth quarter and allowed the Jaguars to tie. And the fact that they had enough heart to be able to beat the Jags in overtime, I tip my hat to them. And, oh, yeah, the Giants lost, so they're 0-4.
Right.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
That's fun, but and to watch the baseball season come to a limping end. To lose 11-0 to the Phillies, who finished even lower than the Mets did,
right,
was just painful. But Terry Collins has resigned as manager, so it's on to a different direction.
Yeah.
And now this coming week we get to suffer, as I always do, with the start of the hockey season, because you know what's going to happen with the Rangers. They're going to start strong. Lundqvist is going to get hurt. Fuck the team like he always does. And we're going to limp our way into an early exit from the playoffs.
Yeah, right. Well, it's the same thing with the Blues. I don't even bother with the Sabres anymore, because outside of Jack Eichel, there's really no reason to watch those games. But as far as the St. Louis Blues are concerned, it's the same kind of thing. They're stocked with talent. They saw a couple of high-profile departures in the offseason, but they also brought in some decent talent to shore things up. And it's all going to depend on how the goaltending is. And if it falters halfway through the season, or if there's an injury in goal, forget it. They're done.
The one thing I can hope for with the Rangers, because I'm telling you right now, I give it 3 weeks max before Lundqvist goes down for the first time.
Yeah, right.
Not kidding. Because he's done this to them for the last 3 years.
Yep.
The only thing I can really hope is that Shattenkirk really does play up to what we think he can play coming home. Because, again, you know, there's always that argument that, you know, hometown boy comes in for a big contract and just underperforms. He didn't take the big contract.
Right.
He wanted to play for the Rangers.
Yeah.
So he took less for less time. Therefore, let's see him do his thing the right way.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see. So we'll keep our fingers crossed for that. And that brings us quite nicely into In Our Heads. And this week, this is kind of going out on a limb, because I couldn't help it. I mean, it just happened. When I was watching what was going on out of Las Vegas, when I turned on the TV this morning and saw that awful headline, and started to hear a little bit about him, and there's more differences than there are similarities. But the one name that kept ringing through my head, because this guy was up on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel when he started shooting, is Charles Whitman. And what this has to do with music is that Charles Whitman, in addition to being the shooter on the Texas Tower in, 1966,
yes,
and all of the horrible things that happened on that day, It also happened to spawn one of my favorite Kinky Friedman songs ever, The Ballad of Charles Whitman.
He was sitting up there for more than an hour, way up there on the Texas Tower, shooting from the 27th floor. He didn't choke or slash or slip him, not our Charles, Joseph Whitman. He won't be an architect no more. Got up that morning, calm and cool. He picked up his guns and walked to school. All the while he smiled so sweetly that it blew their minds completely. They'd never seen an Eagle Scout so cruel.
It's hilarious. I mean, in context of the time, maybe not so much, but still, it's a great kind of weird Western, you know, ballady thing, and it's just a very strange tune. But he got inspired to write this song, and that was, boy, 1973, I think, when Overnight Sensation came, or not Overnight Sensation, that's Zappa, when Sold American came out. And so it had been a good 6 or 7 years between one and the other, but still, that idea of getting a great song out of tragedy is not something that's limited to that, because even if it's a fake tragedy, songs like Blood Rock's DOA, which is about a plane crash, it's
holy shit, I can't believe you just brought up Blood Rock. Wow. I mean, I was listening to them like 2 weeks ago.
Were you really? Yeah. See, it just goes to show. But that song, as creepy, and I mean, we are into October now, so Halloween is only 4 weeks away. But as creepy as that song is, how odd to get out of a plane crash that never even really happened a song like DOA. So what are those songs for you? The ones that are about the most horrifying of subject matters and still ended up turning out a pretty good song.
Well, one of the first ones I can think of is That Smell by Skinner.
Ooh, that smell. Can't you smell?
The line, that smell, the smell of death, it's around you, you know? Isn't that foreboding?
You know? Right, yeah. Well, and he always said he wasn't going to live past 31. He didn't.
Man, that's a good question. Out of real life tragedy, well, I don't consider it a great song, but it's a very powerful one, and it's I Don't Like Mondays.
Yes.
You know?
The Boomtown Rats.
Ironic that today's Monday, too.
Right.
That all this happened after midnight on a Monday.
Yep. And I Don't Like Mondays. Yeah, it was about the teacher who shot up the class. Or the girl who shot up the class.
And, you know, another one a song that was born of tragedy, one of the few that don't make me hate the song, because there were so many of these fucking songs in the aftermath. But Empty Garden, Hey, Hey, Johnny by Elton John.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about John Lennon. Death, because so many of those fucking songs appeared. I mean, I wanted to slap Harrison for all those years ago.
And here today, yeah.
Is a really, it's beautiful, but you know, I'll give Paul the pass simply because it was a direct statement to Lennon. It wasn't about, you know, it wasn't like an overall, you know, reminiscence for everybody to share. It was just Paul to John. That's it.
You know, one just occurred to me, too, out of that same realm of disaster songs. What was the one that the Bee Gees did about the mining disaster? Do you remember?
Oh, the mining disaster 1941.
Yeah.
In the event of something happening to me, there is something I would like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones.
That was their first American hit.
Right.
Great way to start your career, you know, with the Maudlin and
right.
The Bizarro.
Well,
although, yeah. It's got to be said, if you go back to those Bee Gees' earliest albums, they're all psychedelic and completely nuts.
Right. Oh, I love that stuff. I liked it a whole lot better than the disco era stuff. But at the same time, that's not the only song about a mining disaster either. Let us not forget Timothy by the Buoys.
Wow, that is really mining for obscurity.
You remember that song? It's ostensibly about, according to the band, they said that Timothy was actually the minecart mule. But what we all really know it's about is a bunch of guys that got trapped in a mine and had to eat one of the guys that got trapped down there with them.
You know what? If anybody was a vegetarian, all I can say is this much. Tastes like chicken.
There you go. Yeah. And, well, of course, American pie, too.
Well, here's the problem. You're never going to get a straight answer out of Don McLean.
No.
He'll probably slap you. Second of all, that's, you know, we are given to understand it's about the death of rock and roll by virtue of the Buddy Holly plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you know, now that we're talking about it, on a similar plane, it was a little odd that Eddie Cochran's last single was Three Steps from Heaven.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a, you know, say what you will about that, you know.
How many car crash songs were there, too?
Oh, God. Well, I mean, you know, Tell Laura I Love Her, Leader of the Pack.
Dead Man's Curve.
Dead Man's Curve's classic. That's probably the best out of all of them. You know, in its own way, Don't Worry Baby is kind of a really that's heading for disaster.
Yep.
You know, think about it.
And then there was a disaster of a song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Oh, well, now, come on. The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald is a stroke of genius by virtue of the fact that it's a completely memorable melody.
Yes.
It's how long? 6 minutes and change?
6:11, I think. Yeah.
Okay. It's about a real event. And there are so many lyrics and verses to that. I mean, I've got to give Gordon Lightfoot all the credit in the world. I really hate, If You Could Read My Mind, Love.
Oh, yeah.
Sundown is one of the greatest songs of all time.
Agreed.
That, you know what? Because he wrote that, I'll give him the pass for Edmund Fitzgerald. Although, you know, you know who the subject matter was of the song Sundown?
Yeah, and I can't pull it out of my head.
Kathy Evelyn Smith, the woman who shot up John Belushi at Chateau Marmont.
Right, right.
So there you go. I mean, there's some creepy little tie-ins. It's all kind of weird forms of synchronicity, I suppose.
Oh,
you know?
The tragedy is everywhere. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it seems odd to me that there was never anything, because Take the Skinheads Bowling predated Columbine, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
That's not about, it's, you know, it's not one about the other.
Bowling was 87.
Yeah, I thought it was, see, it went back that far, and Columbine was like 95.
Those guys just write nothing but goofy comedy songs. You
know? Right, yeah.
Yeah, Border Ska, come on. There is one I actually thought of I only just realized it now because it's incredibly personal, become incredibly personal to me. The song Camera from Reckoning was written by the band and Stipe about Stipe's girlfriend, Carol Levy, who was a photographer and a member of the band Bodov, I think. And she had died in a car wreck in the spring of 83.
Okay.
And, you know, that song, that event in many ways destroyed Stipe emotionally. And he wrote the song, and you can hear his voice in the register. It's not quite right when you listen closely in the headphones. It's a very mournful, very somber song. You know, the lyrics is, "She will be remembered." Well, that happened to have been my girlfriend Susan's favorite REM song. And now I can't listen to it, because if I do, there's just no way I can't. I can't listen to it. Yeah. I can't even talk about it at length.
It just brings it all back.
It just is so painful to think about the fact that she's not here anymore. And, you know, so it's the tie of a real event, a tragic event turned into a song and now brought home even closer because this was someone who is no longer in this world and in my life who loved that song.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful song, but when you know the story behind it, it becomes all the more poignant. For me, it's just even much more harder hitting.
I hear you.
Well, I don't mean, you know, wrap that little part up on a somber note.
Well, I will hit you with one more because just to sort of save it from that, there's another song that, even though I think it was on his best of, it never really, I mean, if you ask people about it, most of them won't even be able to identify it as such. But Peter Gabriel had a song called Family Snapshot that's a story about an assassination, a political assassination, told from the perspective of the shooter. And it's, I'll just say this, it's worth a listen because it's not anything like you would expect it to be. It's a very, in that same way, kind of mournful, we're resigned to this, you and I, being the shooter and his target. And it's a very strange take, but it's a great song. It's one of my favorites from him.
I'll stick with And Through the Wire.
There you go.
Well, you know why.
Tell.
Who's playing guitar on that? Mr. Weller.
Oh, Paul Weller. Okay, of course.
When you think about, because when I heard that Weller played guitar on that, I was, that can't be. 1980? Weller would never play with somebody like Peter Gabriel from Genesis? The fuck? No. He's playing. First of all, you could tell it's him. Is that Rickenbacker slash it up?
Yeah.
He's on it. Dave Gregory from XTC is on it. I mean, that was, first of all, it's Gabriel's best album.
Yeah.
But that's Gabriel at his new wave weirdest, that's what I love about it, because that's the one that's got, Jus sans frontière, you know, Hans spielt mit Lotti, Lotti spielt mit Jane, Jane spielt mit Willi, Willi ist gay und froh, you know.
I love that song too. You know, and maybe that can lead us into our next in our heads, and we could talk about nuclear war songs. Won't that be fun?
Oh, Jesus. Well, I can go right to. We had one.
Oh yeah.
I wrote one at 15, and it made its way into the 2 minutes hate, and then subsequently into the punchline set. It stayed with us, called "Perfect Setting for a Third World War."
Yeah, that's cool.
I mean, yeah, well, talk about fucking cheerful. Well, I was obsessed with Armageddon coming. So.
Well, I'll just say Two Suns in the Sunset, and we'll leave it at that. Rob Ross, next time, and have yourself a wonderful week, my man.
You too, brother. Be well. I'll talk to you soon.